Good evening. Welcome to Meetup, Marie and Oscar. Glad to see you. And Emily is here. What a treat. Good to see you. Let's do introductions around.
Wendy.
Jeffrey.
Judy.
Marie.
Karen.
Sonia.
Oscar.
Maria.
Emily.
Carolyn.
And Angie. So we're about halfway through Suzuki Roshi's book called Branching Streams in the Darkness, and it's based on a very old poem that we just recited about the this and the that of everything, the dark and the light and the up and down and the foot in the back and the foot in the front. It's all separated into one thing and another, and yet it all belongs together. So it's very hard to talk about because we want things to be either one thing or the other. That's how our mind works. And it takes an extra little bit of thought or a little wrench in the brain to understand that it can be both and. That two things can be true at the same time. We know that. We see the psychological test of the lady with the beautiful face, but if you look at it long enough, you can see it's also a witch. Same drawing, exactly the same, but it depends on what you see. So everything depends on our ability to take in with the taste and the touch and the sight of our life and interpret it and try to understand it, although the truth is we'll never really understand it. And yet the joy of life as human beings is this effort to know, to experience, to touch and be touched, and to know. And with this broader view, it creates a kind of joyous experience in our life because we know about the individuality of things, and yet we also know how big life is and how it includes everything we can ever imagine. I've just been reading an essay on beauty of all things, and in it Elaine Scarry tells about how she loves trees. And she was sort of picking out the trees she loved the best. And one of them was the sycamore, which made me think of this beautiful tree right outside the door. And she said when she went to Los Angeles, she saw palm trees sort of from a distance. And there they were, this long bare stalk and then this sort of frowsy thing up at the top. And she thought, they're not beautiful at all. They're not even pretty. And then she was given a room at a hotel up in the face of the top of a palm tree. And she stood on the balcony and watched it in the wind. And she said it was the most remarkable experience she had ever had. It was waving in the wind, this fronds, this feathery, flashing different colors all through the day and then into the night. She couldn't leave. She had to be there for it the whole time. And then she finished by saying, now I wonder about the shards that are lying on the floor of my mind that I've that I just have rejected the whole time that are probably just as beautiful as that. So it's wonderful to be reminded. So in this chapter with Suzuki Roshi, instead of talking about beauty, he talks about earwigs, which is everybody's favorite enemy in the garden, you could say. I remember when I had artichokes, and you pick an artichoke fresh from the, and you take it into the kitchen, and then an earwig would stick up out of it. Hello. So the verse that he's addressing is the eye and sight, ear and sound, nose and smell, tongue and taste. Thus, for each and everything, depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth. Trunk and branches share the essence. Revered and common, each has its speech. This is the same as Thich Nhat Hanh's rose. The rose makes a beautiful flower, and then the flower falls, and then it makes a beautiful fruit from that flower. And then the fruit falls, and the seeds are inside. And this tiny, tiny seed then makes a new stalk, and there's a new flower. Where does it begin, and where does it end? What is the rose? There is no the rose. There is roseness, the process of rosing. He says, when each being includes the whole world, then each being is actually independent. Said, reality from the viewpoint of independence about eyes and ears and nose and tongue, that if you see something, it seems like I'm seeing that. I'm seeing this. But in fact, this and that, or me and it, are all belonging to the same system, you could say. That there's no me without this, and there's no this without me. And so as we identify ourselves and experience with our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, we interpret what we feel and see and take it in as something. It's how the mind works. We create things out of this whole mush of everything that we experience. It's really a much bigger mush than we really recognize, because we pick things out to pay attention to. And we overlook an awful lot. And often in our life we overlook each other. We overlook the rock that we stumble on. And that's just in a simple way to talk about it. But it's very, very complex world from which we try to survive by picking out the things that will help us and picking out the things that will be in our way. But knowing that this is what we're doing is a really important step, because if we aren't knowing that, then we're beginning to separate ourselves in a way that isn't true. And refusing to see deeply what it is that we do allow ourselves to experience. See it all the way as far down to the bottom as we can in order to understand our connection with the world, because we're not alone. So he says, our thinking mind is what creates the sense of a subject and an object. I'm the subject, this is the object. But this can be the subject of my poem. And then which is the subject, which is the object? And it's all in the mind. All of those are thoughts, ideas, interpretations of some of the mush that this mind, body, eyes, ears is experiencing. He says, usually the reason that people become attached to the objective world or to something they see is because they understand things in only one way. Palm trees are ugly. Their understanding is that something exists independent of them. That's the normal way of understanding. Maybe you will kill some animal or insect, but when you think, there are many earwigs here and they are harmful insects, so I'll have to kill one, you understand things only in a dualistic way. Oh, I don't like palm trees, I'm going to cut them all down. Seen one tree, you've seen them all. So he's suggesting that we look more carefully and understand even an earwig is a life, and it participates in our life, and it creates a dilemma for us, just as everything that we understand about life and death is a dilemma, including our own life and death. We know we have to die, and we know we kill in order to live. So the very first precept is no killing. In Zen, in Buddhism, no killing, the very first one. But of course we pull up the carrots and we chop them up and steam them and they're delicious and we eat them all up. And who knows if they cry when you pull them out of the ground. It's much less squashing earwigs, which is what we have to do also sometimes. And he's pointing out that we need to be extremely aware and mindful of what we're doing and what's doing us, so that we don't blindly and stupidly just create mayhem around us in our world. We're creating a world as we live in what we call the world. Each one of us is a world. And how we enact ourselves and enact the world is, in a sense, our responsibility and the fun of our life, the joy of our life. And it's really, really hard work. So he says, and I think this is the crucial sentence, we should look beyond appearance and know how each thing exists. Because of the root, we exist. Because of the absolute Buddha nature, we exist. Understanding things in this way, we have oneness. And that's what Sekito is saying. Trunk and branches share the essence, revered and common, each has its speech. the words we use are different, good words and bad words, respectful words and mean words. Through these words, we should understand the absolute being or source of the teaching. So he has a famous story at the end of his talk about two monks who are walking along, traveling together, and they come to a river. And standing at the river is a beautiful woman who needs to get across. And so one of the monks picks her up, and they all cross together. And then he puts her down, and the two monks then go on their way. And after about a mile, the one monk turns to the one who carried the woman and said, "You broke the precepts. You picked up a woman. You're not supposed to even touch a woman, and you carried her all the way across the river. How could you do that?" And he turned to him and he said, "Well, I put her down a long time ago. You still seem to be carrying her." It's all in the mind. It's all how we think. So he said, when you're involved in a dualistic sense of the precepts, do this, don't do that, man and woman, monk and layman, if you get involved in a dualistic sense, it's violating the precepts, and it's a poor understanding of Buddha's teaching. Without any idea of attainment, without any idea of doing anything, without any idea of meaningful practice, just to sit is our way. To be completely involved in sitting meditation is our zazen. And this is how we observe our precepts. Sometimes we will be angry. Sometimes we'll smile. Sometimes we'll be mad at our friends, and sometimes we will give them a kind word. But actually, what we are doing is just observing our way. He says, "I cannot explain it so well, but I think you must understand what I mean." And the students talk, ask questions. There's a discussion afterwards where everybody seems a little exercised about the earwig part. Somebody said earwigs go to the source of reality. They know where to go. He said, when we speak in this way, you'll feel that it's just talk. But when you suffer a lot, it will be a great relief to know that. So there must be a discussion for us as well. Are there questions, comments? Of any kind for new people? Jeffrey?
Just a moment to share joy. And you know those moments when you discover something brand new, and what is interesting about it is the location of where you discover. So sometimes you discover things in your own backyard. Sometimes you'll, in the case in point, is I went to Half Moon Bay. Some of you may know I'm going through a remodeling process, and it seemed to be a very good place to get away from my own home. And so we went over to the coast, and it was this beautiful day. It was Sunday, just gorgeous. And we went to a beach I'd never been to before. I've driven by it many, many times. It's called Bean Hollow.
I know that beach.
Okay. See, I haven't driven by it. And so I didn't know what was there. And they have this, how many of you have been there? Just Angie? Okay. Well, Angie, you know, they have this formation called Tafoni.
Mm-hmm.
Tafoni was magical. It was unbelievable. And, you know, I was 9 years old and I was climbing all over the tide pools, looking at this amazing geologic formation that I was unfamiliar with. And I appreciate this more the older I get, these moments where I touch the earth in this really new way. I just love that moment. And then I want to talk about another experience, and it has to do with birds. I had an experience last week. It was 2 days after we sat last week. And it was with friends having lunch. We were outside. And I heard a bird making a sound that I'd never heard before. And when I turned, it was a bird I always see in the Central Valley. It's called a red-winged blackbird.
Yeah.
It's got that beautiful little red stripe. And it was making, I'd never heard them before, because I don't live in the Central Valley. I don't have that kind of experience. Exactly. Thank you for making that point. So a few people told me that they're here.
Yeah.
2 days later, I saw another one. It was like I'd only seen them in the Central.
That's how it works.
So I just wanted to share those moments of they're just moments. Just wonderful. And I continue to look forward to having those kind of moments. They do happen with a great deal of regularity.
You're a lucky
man.
But
I wanted to share it.
You're a lucky man. We used to pick mussels off the rocks on that Bean Hollow.
Bean Hollow?
Yeah.
I bet.
Yeah. Take home a bucket and scrub them. My husband set up a little wheel that ran on a motor so we could actually clean the mussels off before we... Because it's a real job. You have to take a brush and you have little hairy things all over them. It's a lot of work for a little meal. But it was very, very fun. Judy?
So, this morning when I was reading this chapter, I found myself thinking about kind of the duality that the chapter was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that when I don't try to think too hard about it, and I kind of open my mind to accept what I'm reading, instead of trying to pick at every little thing, that every word or every phrase, instead of picking at it and just kind of opening my hands and holding it all together, that it's easier to take. I don't know, is that...
Well, the Zazen mind is not an analytical mind. And so it's useless to try to analyze any of this material because it's not coming from there. It's not written from that mind. It's written from the mind of experience, not the mind of thinking. And it's just a different... It's a different matter, a completely different matter. When it opens up, if you read it with your... Read it with your heart and your belly, I always say, and just let your body tell you what it means rather than trying to figure it all out. And we're so well trained to figure everything out, and we've got grades in school for doing that, so it's hard to drop that part of our mind. And that's why Zazen practice is so important, because it gives us an opportunity just to let that all drift away and just not pay any attention to it anymore and just get into a place where it's more quiet. Underneath all the chatter, I always think the blah, blah, blah that goes on and on. Yeah, that's a very important point.
But here's the thing. If you have, a lot of this is about, like, both and duality, right? So if you have that non-analytical mind, you also have the analytical mind, right?
Yes.
It's not, right?
Absolutely. You don't drop the analytical mind. You, as I said, you sit under it when you sit. And when you get up, you hope to be able to engage the whole thing as it's operating in us all the time. It's not like we pick up some new thing. It's always here. It's always with us. It's just that we tend to get caught up in the thingness of things and the analytical side. And that's what Buddha's teaching, his first teaching, was how attached we become to things and how we begin to believe in things, in their whole completeness, as if they're not just something that came into existence and is just as soon as 5 minutes is going to fall all apart again. That we make idols and icons out of all of our stuff, and we try to hold on to it and keep it close to us.
So when you have that the figure, the, you know, the, where you see the woman,
yes,
and the witch, right? They're both there, but you really only have one kind of active at any given time. But they're both. But you can flip back and forth, and you know that they're kind of both there.
Yes,
right?
Yes, and that's the important part. So the intellect is our genius. It's the wonder of the human being. But the other side of it, the untalkaboutable side of it, is also the genius of the human being. Very good point. It's more complicated talking about it than it is living it. Well, it's 8 o'clock. So this is when we have announcements, if there are announcements.
There is a business meeting at about 8:10, a 50-minute business meeting for anyone who'd like to stay for it. And a lot of discussion about our coming sesshin in August.
And thanks for everybody keeping everything running. The spreadsheet seems to be working.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
It did a good job. Well, let's sit for 1 minute.